Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 228. I've completely had a guess at the number there. I'm just checking on my phone. Yes, it's right. That's good news, isn't it? I'm joined this week by Drew Pierce, and it was an absolute joy. Drew had a film out this year called Hotel Artemis, and it blew me away. I absolutely adored it. I got to go to a preview of it. I'd seen the trailer and heard the concept and seen all the people who was in it, from Sophia Boutella, Charlie Day and Dave Bautista and Jodie Foster. And then there was more people who I wasn't that familiar with. And yeah, I'd heard the concept that it's basically a hotel that is a private members hotel that is a hospital for criminals. And just the concept alone I loved. And then I watched the film and was blown away, and I hassled Drew on social media to come and chat with me on the podcast, and I'm delighted I did, because I've had a few this year where I've met someone for the first time. And you've got to remember, I hope it doesn't come across or change the interviews too much, but you've got to remember that I'm full in on acting now and I adore this industry. So it's super exciting if I have someone on who is someone that's on my list of people I'd love to work with, and I feel there's an instant a connection. I had it on the week before last episodes with Bart Layton, Coralie Fargay earlier this year, and Alan Hughes earlier this year. And yeah, in the past, all sorts of people. But yeah, Drew was one of them. He's someone that I'm a fan of his work and would like to work with in the future. And it's always a good sign when you meet, it is just comfortable and relaxed. Because I genuinely, my limited experience of this film industry is that it's a long and tiring game to make films and to make TV. So genuinely getting on with people helps. Do you know what I mean? So there is an urgency or a desire to work with people, not only that are super talented and right for the roles and all this kind of thing, but also that extra element of being able to imagine spending time with them or getting on with them and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's a fascinating one and I love it. I should mention that you guys have been amazing in this last week. Last week I announced I've launched a Patreon, and my Patreon, all you do is it's 80p a month or $1 a month, and that's it. There's no tiers or deals or trying to tempt you to more. It's simply, if you wish to support the podcast, my script writing, all these other things, to allow me to continue to do it without ever looking at the dollar value of a guest, of a subject or whatever else, just doing what's interesting and right, then you can go and chip in there. And someone asked me recently, since I launched it, they said, oh, it's great news that you've done this, but why? What's changed your mind on it? Because people have been asking me for years to do a Patreon. Patreon themselves hit me up like within the first year or two of them coming up or coming about and asked me to if I'd like to join. And it wasn't for me. But to explain, I've never been against Patreon. It's why I've actively pushed the hardcore list in Patreon, the Limmy one, numerous other Patreons. But for me, I've never wanted to make my living off of a kind of a donation type setup. And that's just a personal choice. And I continue on that. I realised I didn't really explain when I announced it last week. I kind of touched on it, but all of the money from the Patreon goes directly into my business. And the business is what pays for travel and stuff like that for the podcast. Say I need to go away and do some writing, or go away and do some acting meetings and stuff like that. It funds all of that. So none of it is paying my mortgage or my electric bills. That is all paid by sponsors. And I've always said from day one, I like having sponsors because they mean that you guys get the podcast for free. I'd rather they pay, you know, my bills and you guys get the podcast for free. But this is just giving you that option if you want to pay the 80p or a pound a month. So yeah, that money goes into the business, and then that can help pay Barley Peace, who produces the podcast, John, who runs the social media, John Harris, and stuff like that, and people along the way. And also, it kind of opens things up to, I've always been at the mercy of, the guests are a case of who's in town or when I'm in town. And if the Patreon takes off, then it means I can travel to people more or pay for people to travel here, put them up in hotels, all that kind of thing. All the stuff that basically big companies like the BBC or whomever else, they have all of that stuff. That's all part of their infrastructure. And it's mad that the Distraction Pieces podcast is now rubbing shoulders with all of these. As I mentioned on the Spike Lee one, the only people who got to chat to him on that day was the BBC, Jonathan Ross, who was just launching his new huge show on ITV, and me, and Blind Boy. And it's mad that just two podcasters are getting to mix in that. But yeah, I want to be able to fund all of that and push these things through. As I've said, I always like people, my preferred way for making more kind of, my way of making money in the past has always been, it's why I'm very creative on my merch and stuff like that, because I like the exchange of, here's some money for something. And I've always been, as anyone who's been to speechdevelopmentrecords.com will know, I'm creative with stuff there. But yeah, that was the idea of the Patreon. So if you head to patreon.com/scroobiuspip, you can become a patron. It shows how new I am to it. I was banging on last week that the only option is 80p, a dollar a month. That's it. That's all you can pay. But I didn't know that on any tier, admittedly, I said, I've only got one tier, so that is the only default option. But on any tier, you can overpay. So it's been beautiful to see a handful of people paying more than that, even though I hadn't said that was an option. Just choosing to pay $2 a month or $3 a month or $4 a month. The reason I said I've not had any extra tiers or added any of that is because of the existence of Netflix and Amazon Prime and Spotify and stuff like that. And this is sounding weird. I'm going off on a little weird mental tangent here. But I honestly don't believe that if I charge you a fiver a month or whatever Netflix is, there's no way I can offer the content that they can offer. So I will feel I'm ripping you off there. Whereas 80p a quid a month just to support all of the different projects and art, I get that, and that's cool. So yeah, if you want to pay more, you can, but that's how it's all set up. You set your subscription up and then you forget about it, and you will never remember or notice that $1 a month going out. But it will help fund tons of cool shit that I'm working on, and that'd be cool. Again, also, I said when I started it, I'm not going to be doing anything on there. There's nothing that's just for Patreons. I'm a curious little beast. I've already started doing a few posts and that because I was overwhelmed by, you know, a few hundred people straight off the bat have jumped on board. That's mad. Again, you could argue that there's tens of thousands who listen. So that means there's tens of thousands who've chosen not to chip in their quid a month. But still, I'm focusing on the good news. Yeah, hundreds of people just straight in. So I've done some posts that I realised that, for example, most episodes I'll take a digital photo as well as the Polaroid in case the Polaroid doesn't work. But because I've recorded them all far in advance, I forget I've taken that and never end up posting it. So I'm posting a few of them up there for the Patreons. I'm doing a few kind of behind-the-scenes stories of all sorts of different things. So yeah, I'll post on there every now and then. But again, that's not the point of it. The point is just if you want to chip in, you can. I just got excited because I realised that a social media platform that I've only got, you know, a few hundred people on, it's far easier to read everything and interact and not miss anything than, obviously, on Twitter I've got, you know, 100-something thousand, and on Instagram it's 50-something thousand, and so on and so forth. So it's harder to keep up on everything there, whereas it's quite cool to have this condensed, here's the streamlined Team 3W hardcore fans. So that's it. I'll probably keep mentioning it, but it's nice if anyone wants to chip in. As said, patreon.com/scroobiuspip. It's just a dollar a month, unless you choose to overpay, which is fine too. But as said, on your head be it, because I'm not the idea of it being kept cheap is that you do it and you forget about it. And if it's a fiver a month, you know, a lot of people will notice that. You know, these things add up, bills add up, it's a forever hard hustle. Whereas I genuinely believe most people who have got kind of the technology to be listening to podcasts and stuff like that, I'm not disrespecting anyone here, but most people who ingest the content I put out wouldn't necessarily notice $1 a month, hugely. And I don't mean that to be insulting if it sounds like I'm saying money means nothing. But yeah, anyway, geez, I'm overthinking all of this, as ever. You'll be able to hear more of that on my Patreon. Yeah, this is Drew Pearce, and it's a cracking episode. He's a cracking dude. I really enjoyed it. I'll be back at the end with more information. I've got a lot of good guests coming up. Who have I got next week? I think next week I'm going straight in with Dolan and Sage. Let me have a quick look before we get into the podcast, because I know some of you don't listen to the post-podcast bits of information. So, no, next week is possibly the best podcast I've done this year, which, considering I've had the Professor Green one this year and the Chili Gonzalez one this year, both of which at the time I claimed were the best of the year. I mean, I've also had Martin Freeman and Simon Pegg this year, and the Kate Nash one was amazing, and Jess Tom. God, there's been some good ones. But next week is Angel Guifria. I'm going to listen and get her name right in the end. It's Guifria. And she's on social media, and she's absolutely amazing. Honestly, it's going to blow your minds. It's a really strong podcast. So that's next week. And then then I'll have Sage and Dolan on, and then, yeah, a load more exciting and wonderful guests to come. Until then, this is episode 228 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the one and only Drew Pearce. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Absolutely. I'll do the podcast thing and start rolling.
Please do.
And continue. We were just talking about kit and podcast going wrong. Not recording.
Seeing your backup reminded me of a story that I genuinely don't think I maybe have never told.
Right.
I don't even know if I've told my wife.
Yeah.
Because it was genuinely one of the most embarrassing situations of my life.
Yeah.
Which was when I was at university, I did a bunch of band interviews backstage and stuff
yeah.
like that. And I met with, what's his name? I'm going to get his name wrong. Martin Rossiter, the lead singer of Gene.
Yes.
Yeah, was
yes.
that his name?
Yeah, it
Very
was.
Very well put together chap.
Yeah.
I liked their first single, I recall. And so,
he lives
yeah.
in Brighton now, I believe.
Oh, does he? There we go.
I was listening to a podcast yesterday, Off the Beaten Track. Oh, no, it's Hardcore Listing. And Preston from the Ordinary Boys was on, and he was saying how up the road is the lead singer of Gene.
Oh, there's so, like yeah. a 90s indie cul-de-sac.
Yeah, strange combination. Yeah.
But so basically, it was for the TV station at my university, and so I went down there, and we'd got a pub basement much like this.
Yeah.
And we were sitting down, and we went to start, and then the cameraman just leaned in and just went, "Forgot the tape," and I was like, "What do you mean you forgot the tape?" It's like, I've forgotten it, completely forgotten it. And so I made an odd decision, which was I simply continued with a 20-minute interview.
Oh, wow.
With no tape in the machine, just praying that he didn't know what the light on the camera did.
Yeah.
And then just styled it out. And it was honestly so horrific.
It's genuinely, that's the most comfortable reaction. Just
yeah.
to go, let's just keep going
let's
and pretend
do
I don't
let's
know.
Just push on through.
If he hadn't told me, then we would deal with it at the end and go, oh, it hasn't worked. This is terrible. Now he's told me, I wish you hadn't. I'd rather you hadn't said anything.
Exactly.
Because I had the wrestler Chris Jericho on my podcast.
Right.
And he's got a big podcast as well. And literally we got, thankfully it was only 10 minutes in. I was recording it at the studios at XFM.
Right.
Because I used to have a radio show there. And they'd let me record my podcast there a while after I'd left. And I got 10 minutes in, he was telling a really good story, and I looked and noticed it wasn't recording.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm just going to let him get to the end of this story, and then start saying something and then notice. So I kind of faked my noticing because I was like, I don't want to interrupt, but equally I don't want to be
surprised.
I'm letting him talk and not say anything. So I was like, also, I just want to say, oh, hang on. Oh, this has gone wrong. It's frozen. I'm going to have to reboot.
I had the horrible thing because I was like 18 or whatever. And like his management, came up at the end, Gene's manager, and was like, oh, that was a great, that's maybe the best TV interview they've done. Can you send us the tape? And I'm like, yeah, of course. Totally. Mate. I mean, student TV. So it's not like we were held to any particularly high standard.
But still, it means something. I mean,
standard of having a tape there, maybe.
Yeah,
would
exactly. That's a decent standard. But it introduces us nicely. I should mention I'm joined today by Drew Pearce. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'm very excited about this because it leads on nicely there. Because I don't talk about this much on the podcast, but because... So a year or two ago, about a year ago, I did my first podcast at a press... A junkie. I generally don't do them because I need a longer amount of time.
Right.
So, for example, again, it's relevant to this. I'm currently lined up to have Dave Bautista on in a couple of weeks. But it's one of them where they're going, we're going to have to see how... Because if it's less than half an hour, I have to pass. Even if it's someone like Bautista, who I'm a wrestling fan, I'm a film fan, all of this, he's right for it. But if it's not the right amount of time, I'd rather that slot go to someone else.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
I did my first ones a year or so ago, and it was James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender and Eddie Izzard were my first three, and they're all great. And all of them, purely by... it's Michael Fassbender and Eddie in particular. The talent and the actual production companies, it was their favourite interviews of that press run. So it's got me on kind of the thumbs up good list. So it means that I spend a lot of my time at the moment going to previews of films.
Right.
So they all hit me up, and there's every week it's like there's a few films on, so if I can make it, I'll go along, because again, I like to have big names, but also like just stuff that's good. And and one of the previews I went to was your new film, your directorial debut, a Hotel Artemis, and it blew me away. I absolutely adored it. So it was great to kind of to line this conversation up as such. Like I came out of it and messaged Sophia Bertella immediately, who I've had on the podcast previously, just with sheer excitement. And
she's amazing in the movie.
Amazing, absolutely. And so how has it been? I mean, I want to get into the minutiae of it all as we go along. We'll avoid spoilers, because I think it's an easy one to avoid spoilers, because there's so much to talk about that isn't spoiling anything.
Absolutely. Plus, to be fair, every single commercial for it spoiled pretty much the entire movie.
How's it been having your directorial debut? Like, again, we'll get into at the end. Like, you've written a lot in the past, and you've got a decent amount of experience. But this is your first. This was your baby, as such, and you've put together an amazing cast. And it just feels like, as it ended, I thought you must have had so many moments of sheer joy. The completing of the writing and knowing you've got something good, then getting that amazing cast, then finishing shooting it and going, it looks brilliant. And then, do you know what I mean? It coming out and being going well.
Moments of joy.
So how's it been?
Moments of joy. Let me remember if there were any of those. it's interesting. It was, as you say, it's my directorial debut. Yeah. I've been, lucky enough to be writing big movies in America for like the last 8 or 9 years.
Yeah.
Like Iron Man and Mission Impossible. But with this first movie as a director, I wanted to do something that was a bit more handmade and a bit more of me, really. So that's how Hotel Artemis came about. A little idea in a notepad 7 or 8 years ago turned into a whole film. And truthfully, I didn't even really expect it to come out in cinemas.
Wow.
The thing is, it's got this amazing starry cast, like Jodie. I mean, it's just an insane cast. Yeah. Everyone in it is a movie star. But it was made for absolutely fuck all money.
Yeah, it's got the feel of an indie that everyone's pulling together. Yet it's got the glow of a Hollywood because of the cast.
To a degree, I think that's maybe confused some people as well. I think some people have walked in expecting it sometimes to be a thing that it isn't.
Yeah.
And I think it's more in the lineage of the little films that probably you grew up with, like me, like the kind of the original Terminator rather than Terminator 2, which is really just a story about three people running around downtown LA one night.
Yeah.
Um, Or Repo Man, or all of those kind of Alex 100%. Cox, Videodrome, you know, kind of movies.
Is that a slight look into the future, but a grubby, grimy future?
Yeah,
still.
A grubby, grimy future, and also like, and also just as a style of film, there was that weird. I don't know. I think this is all going to kind of sound bigger than it is in a strange way, but yeah. I think we're in an interesting place in the culture where even our more like even the more obscure movies need to kind of the audience needs them to be very streamlined and I wanted to make something that still had all the kind of bumps on it really literally in that like there are a few camera moves in the movie which are which I could have digitally like smoothed out because there's like little human error in them and I was like, do you know what, it's not that film, it's that it should have a handmade quality to it, so.
And that's what I loved about it, and I think you're right, there is a weird pressure at the moment for every film to be the best film ever, but I don't mean that as in the best to be the biggest and most explosive, particularly if anything sets slightly in the future, and
yeah,
I feel,
right.
I really enjoyed Mute. I thought Mute was really good fun. I thought it was dark and weird, but because people, I feel some of the negative response was because you're going in expecting a futuristic sci-fi, a Hollywood blockbuster, but it's a gritty, weird, uncomfortable
little
indie film
that moves
at weird paces.
Yeah, totally.
That's what I loved about it. But that kind of people go in like, right, no, this has to be a blockbuster
of some sort. And by the way, that's not necessarily people's fault. I mean, it's slightly how it's sold as well.
Completely, but, it's the marketing of the day.
Yeah, and actually, truthfully, like, in the UK, I think it was marketed really well. In the States, it was genuinely like, oh, this is the new John Wick. And it's like, well, no. I mean, there's only about 3.5 minutes of fighting in the whole film. It's more like, as you say, like a dark, twisty, grimy kind of, but quite talky movie. Yeah. It was one of the reasons that I kind of designed it as my first film is I was like, I'll get this bunch of characters and then I'll like pair them off in different interesting combinations and see what happens when they rub up against each other.
Yeah.
But that all that said, I mean, like, I definitely don't have any complaints about that. And I think it was funny. Like, I was saying this to someone last night. I went around, I did like, you know, 600 interviews promoting the movie in every, like, in all the territories it's coming out. And in all of them, I was very clear that, like, in my day job, you know, writing big, really big films, you know, we try and shoot for something great, but on a base level, they have to be okay for everyone,
right? Of course.
And so I went around saying that and then saying, and for my first movie, I wanted to make something that wasn't just okay for everyone. It was one person's favorite movie.
Yeah.
And like, that kind of sounded like shtick in the end, but it was absolutely true. It was the mantra that me and Adam Siegel, who was the producer, went into the movie with. But what's really weird is then the movie came out in the States and it's lots of people's favorite movie, which is fantastic, but not everyone liked it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, why doesn't everyone like it? And I hadn't even been listening to the culture of like, needing everything to be liked by everyone is so pervasive. It's like I hadn't even heard my own words.
It's so easy to slip into it when you're in any of those big industries, though. I remember when I first started doing music, our style was so unlike anything else. It was meant to be off the side, but it happened that our first single got in the charts.
Absolutely.
So suddenly I was like, so why don't they all like the third single? And isn't that, it's the same thing.
It's a weird trap. And it's also a weird trap because I don't know, maybe all the artists have always felt like that. But there's a part of me that's like, again, to talk about Repo Man, like, there were maybe two of us at my school that liked Repo Man.
Yeah.
And no one else had heard of it. And if they did see it, they were like, this is fucking weird. I hate it. And that was not only a badge of honour for us, but I suspect Alex Cox didn't care whether anyone liked it or not. He made the movie for him. But maybe he didn't. Maybe he was like, why wasn't this bigger? It's an intriguing one, and it definitely feels like an interesting... It feels like it's a part of a wider move in the culture. Again, without wishing to sound like, you know, like banging a drum that I read in think pieces all the time... Yeah. Like the kind of thumbs up or thumbs down algorithm culture that is literally just a thing is either good or it is bad. and there is nothing in between.
Completely.
And there is this, and there's a kind of hive mind opinion. None of my favorite pieces of art, whether it was a film, piece of music, you know, have ever, certainly when they came out, been everybody's cup of tea. And it's funny, because when you're actually on the promotional trail, like promoting a movie, particularly when someone brilliant like Warner Brothers is putting it out in England, you can't really say that in an interview.
Yeah.
You can't. It somewhat goes against the spirit of them putting you in an interview room for you to go, I love it. Bunch of people I know really love it. Might not be your cup of tea. I can't tell until you go see it.
The slogan of the record label I started, Speech Development Records, is, we may not be for you, and that's fine. and that's literally it. It sums up. It's my outlook on all things, even on the podcast one. I'll have a lot of people who love it. I'll have someone every now and then who's like, I don't like this about it or that about it, and I'll kind of be like, that's okay. There's loads of podcasts out there.
I'm like the proof of concept for you. I'm like the one where people are like, I really love Martin Freeman. I really love Simon Pegg. I have no fucking idea who this Drew Pearce bloke is. But maybe, you know, and I'm okay with that too. So
I love it though. And it is a weird thing. There's also a weird thing in society these days of constant comparison. And it's worst of all when there's sequels or franchises.
Yep.
Deadpool 2, is it as good as Deadpool 1? I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it is what I'm telling you. I'm telling you it's good. Is it as good? It's the argument I came up, or when Deadpool came out, I was doing a podcast with some mates because I raved about Deadpool, and a few people were like, is it as good as Guardians? And I was like, well, I don't know.
It's an entirely different film.
Oh, that was it. Is it as good as ice cream? Is it as good as blowjobs? I don't know. It's they're all by the way, that are great.
And by the way, you've set a very high bar for any movie there.
I know.
Is it as good as ice cream or blowjobs? I mean,
again, that's it. It's the stupid comparisons that people like to put in there. So,
I mean, do you think it is because of a certain algorithm culture? Do you think it is that thing that, like, you know, post web, everything is like is ranked and, you know, put into lists?
I think it's a combination of that and the fact that people now feel pressure to have an opinion on everything.
Oh,
and the
that's
easiest route to have an opinion is comparing to something else. It's why all the
Put a number on
the not as good music journalists, it'll always be they're the new this, or they're the new that, or they're the new whoever, rather than talking about who they are. Do you know what I mean? There'll always be that comparison.
It's an easier way to express an opinion, right? Like a less eloquent way expressing an
opinion.
It's
like this, or it's like that, and so on and so forth.
But, well, which is weird as well, because then the trouble is, if you make something, and I'm not saying that, like, my movie is entirely original, and you've never seen anything like it. It's not a Gaspar Noé film. But I do think it purposefully doesn't fit inside any particular genre box.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that also plays into a certain discomfort in a modern audience sometimes.
100%.
It's the same with, I don't know if you know this about, like, modern movie trailers.
Yeah.
But the way they're cut now, 9 times out of 10, is that the audience don't want to be teased by a trailer.
Yeah.
They want to see the whole movie in the trailer.
It's madness.
And it's not actually, it's basically a proof of concept.
Yeah.
It's literally like, show me the thing that I should spend my money on.
I only, for years now, I only watch trailers in the cinema at all. Just because if I'm going to get things spoiled, I'd rather still have it in that big impact.
Yeah, that's right.
Than on my phone. It's like, because I genuinely, I've talked about this before, but the third Dark Knight film, with Bane in, I thought it was good, but it didn't have any of the impact of the last two, because the most beautiful, amazing scene in the football stadium, I'd seen on the trailer.
He has the voice of an angel.
And that's it. It was amazing.
It's my favourite scene as well, actually.
But I'd already seen it. And I'd already seen the plane scene in the trailer.
So it was
the two big impact things weren't impactful, because that got me excited for the film.
Yeah.
Do you think that is it's harder to get people into the cinema? So people are having to go, here's everything.
Yeah.
To really reel them in.
I think it's not even reeling them in. I think it's almost like, here is the exact thing that you can go and
see.
You can have more of it, but like, this is the exact thing you're going to see. Is that enough to take you out of your living room and your Amazon Prime and your and your Netflix and go to a cinema?
Yeah.
And I think it really... By the way, maybe that's okay.
Yeah.
It's just, I think... I mean, even in the time of making Artemis, the essentially the 2 years of kind of genuine production and releasing it, and that's the shortest period of time you can essentially make a movie like that in. Even in that time, the landscape changed.
Yeah.
So fast. Even in the time since, like, someone bought it in March. You know, I don't think by, you know, we're recording this, you know, at the end of July. I think by October, the consensus will be with, like, major movie studios that unless there is a genuine reason for a movie to be in a theatre, that they just won't bother.
I think you're right. And I think it's constantly changing and it's scary. Yeah, it's a weird one. It means that good films, and not good, because I love a blockbuster as
Me too.
I love the superhero movies.
I mean, I fucking
movies.
Love my, this, so. Both my jobs, making small movies and like making big movies.
Yeah, and it's one of them, but it means that the more artistic movies are only ever going to be made as passion projects, which makes them a lot harder to be made.
And also their scale is instantly, you know, affected. I mean, I think the I've been doing the list myself, you know, because it's kind of like, well, what do I want to make as my next directorial movie? And definitely as a 40-year-old, you just now have to let go of the idea that every movie you make will be a theatrical movie.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you ask me now about Hotel Artemis, should it have been, you know, in theaters? I mean, I'm unbelievably glad it was, because it was designed for theaters. And you know, my cinematographer is Chung Hoon Chung, who did the original Old Boy and does all of Director Park stuff.
Yeah.
So it looks sumptuous and it was designed for a 100%. Big screen. But, like, I honestly think its main audience will be in streaming. I think it will be it's like a midnight movie. It's a comeback from the pub and watch it for the fourth time kind of movie.
Because that's it. The thing that blew me away the most about it, and it's interesting because I'm writing a load of scripts at the moment, and one of them has been optioned by Warp, and it's a TV show. And again, it's a similar one where we've gone to certain channels and they've said, oh, it's a 10 p.m. show. We've got them at the moment.
Yeah.
And I've literally said to Warp, we'll go back in 6 months because 10 p.m. shows already don't exist now, but aren't going to exist in 10 months. It's going to be...
Time is irrelevant.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You record it. It finds its audience.
Absolutely.
That's it. So it's a similar thing the speed of that. But on the film front, one of the things that excited me about it, and it's instantly the guy I'm writing a feature film with, I sent him to go and see Hotel Artemis, because it's a similar thing where, as a concept alone, it sells. Mm-hmm. It's a private members club hospital for criminals.
Yep.
That simple as a one line, you're like, that's amazing. Why hasn't this been done? But then what made it special was you didn't coast on that. Like, it would have been easy to go, and it's what most of the classic B movies have been.
Yeah.
We've got an idea, let's just start filming it. Do you know what I mean? And that's what didn't happen here is...
And by the way, I think some of the audience would have preferred if I'd done that. Because really, it's a movie about a little old... It's like a fairy tale about a little old lady and her grief. And like the way she's worked out her grief cycle for 22 years.
And again, it puts someone with anxiety issues at the forefront.
Yeah,
and at no point kind of makes it slapstick or comedy. Nope. It's always dramatic. And that's what I loved about it. I'd heard the idea... I love Dave Bautista, I love, you know, Jeff Goldblum. Everyone involved was like, this is an amazing cast. So I was up for it on that respect. And then when I actually watched it, I was like, wow, it had more than I wanted.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It had all of that. It had the intimacy of the cast. I've not even mentioned Charlie Day yet, who's just amazing. So
he is.
Again, it had all of these actors and it felt, exactly as you said, you had this amazing cast that you could then, rather than just speed through a story, you could put them and see how they interact and see how they change each other's perspectives and things like
honestly,
that.
Honestly, that was the kind of... That was the point of the film. And that was how I was able to make it, because, you know, if it had more than 5 minutes of action, I wouldn't be able to afford it. It's a little movie. It's like a bubble episode. You know, and of course, like, you know, John Carpenter was the master of making lock-in movies, essentially, yeah. You know, in like Precinct 13 and in The Thing.
Yeah.
But I also, I don't know, you remember that thing when in the video shop, if it was a good video shop, curated by someone awesome and a bit weird,
yeah,
like they would put Diva or Subway or something like that, next to Star Wars. And the cases were so evocative and that, you know, even as a 12-year-old, you might end up watching what's essentially like a French art house sci-fi movie just because the one you came in to buy was gone.
Yeah.
There was a space there and you were like, well, that one's next to it. Yeah. And I wanted, as a first movie as a director, I just wanted it to have that kind of the flavor of those kind of movies growing up. But maybe also, you know, one of the things I've considered in the last few weeks is, well, all my reference points for the movie were things I saw on video when I was a kid. And maybe that's the point. Maybe like Netflix is the equivalent of the thing you see on video rather than go to the cinema.
Completely.
So it's, I mean, it's, and you know, it's my job to write and direct films. So I probably am thinking about this at the moment a lot more than most people are. Most people are just like, well, what's on? All right, I'll go and see that.
It makes tons of sense. Oh, it's fucking hot.
Maybe I'll go to a cinema.
Yeah, but it's a tough one because, again, I'm adamant fan of the cinema. I believe that things should be in there. And I go several times a month and have to travel into London for anything good and all that. Right. But it means the world. So it saddens me that there's going to be a point that things aren't going in that way. But it also, I understand it and it makes sense. And it means that people will be able to continue to take risks in film, which is more important, I guess, than where it's watched. As much as the cinema means to me, the fact that people will still be able to take risks because of the kind of
digital approach. And I think it's the difference between like being a grumpy old person about technology changing things and actually trying to listen to the change in medium and changing storytelling to go with it. You know, like, it's a bit like you were saying, like, in the same way that there won't be any, you know, 10 p.m. shows in 6 months' time because time is irrelevant, you know.
Completely.
When it comes. But, you know, who's to say how long a story should be? A story should just be the length it is, particularly if it's on Netflix because it's not about.
I agree more.
And that's actually my problem with a lot of, you know, golden era TV is I think it still stretches out its stories. You know, one of the things I loved about doing Hotel Artemis Night and that I love about films is they're more like a short story. They're like a novella. Like they have very much a kind of, you know, you're in that world very hermetically.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing about the cinema experience. And God, like all of the research says this is changing. You know, when you sit down in the cinema and, you know, the lights go down, I've kind of got you for 90 minutes. I mean, if you need a wee, you can leave, but I'm hoping you don't.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's, you know, and Hotel Artemis is like 92 minutes long, and I love a bullet of a movie.
Yeah.
But all the evidence at the moment, research-wise, suggests that that one of the reasons that people resent going to the cinema, other than for like giant blockbusters, is because they're so used to being able to control the viewing experience, they feel uncomfortable not being able to pause it, not being able to exert their own control on the narrative of like their 2 hours.
I don't think they deserve control. it should be in the hands of those who've crafted this story and painted it. It does infuriate me. Like, again, it's an ongoing thing. I'll get annoyed with my mum or my dad if I'm ever around there and we're watching something and they'll get up to go to the toilet. But like, you know, this is still on and this is happening. And
you'll miss a bit.
And from your point of view, if you think about the minutiae of things that went back and forth on the edit that you were like, no, we need to extend that it's a tiny like bit frames, and change that. And it's like frames. The effort that's gone in there and someone even turning away to take a drink, I'm furious with. It's like, just pay attention. Then, and it's why I love the cinema, because it's so there and so unavoidable.
And then maybe the answer to all of this is the movies that now belong in the cinema are the ones that demand you to do that.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I loved Quiet Place this year is that was like a physical experience. I was in a cinema with a bunch of people. I went on like the Friday afternoon that it came out. And by the way, even though that movie was a really big hit, it was still like a cinema with only 25 people in it, always blows. Like, that's the thing that makes me sad is when I go to a cinema on a Friday night or something, and it's like, it's a big movie and it's doing well, and there's still only like 18 people
in
there.
It's killer, isn't it?
But what I loved about A Quiet Place was that it was a physical experience that everyone in the cinema went through.
Yes.
Because even someone eating popcorn threw you off the movie and pissed everyone else off in the theater. And like, it's the first time in a cinema where I've genuinely like not heard a person speak. I literally watched a guy take his popcorn out. All the heads in the cinema turned around and looked at him, and he genuinely like gave a little nod, like, "Yeah, no, not worth it."
I'll leave
and popped it back down again, really gently.
Amazing.
And that's because the movie was great, and in my opinion, and the form of it demanded it. And so maybe as filmmakers and storytellers, we have to look at the cinema space as the thing that deserves and demands that. But as you say, the tricky thing is a lot of the time, the things that deserve and demand a big screen as a story also deserve and demand a big budget, you know?
So did that come into mind when you were deciding what to write as your directorial debut? Because as you said, it's essentially a lock-in movie, which from a production point of view means it's primarily one location.
Technically,
Therefore, although there is a lot going on in it, when you're first writing, I'd imagine the thought would be, well, this is going to be easier to get made.
For sure.
Because it's not this spanning all over the place.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is you don't really get to choose what the first movie you direct is.
Right,
even if you're a writer-director. You know, I've been writing for 15 years, I guess, and I've been directing things on and off during that time, like music videos and shorts and stuff like that. But I wrote 3 spec scripts before this one over the last 10 years to try and be my first movie as a director. And for various different reasons, they didn't get across the line. Like, the last one really nearly did. It was at a major studio, but, you know, it needed one of the 3 or 4 Chris's to say yes, and the Chris's were busy, and and I couldn't get it to them, and so that didn't happen.
It needs a Chris or a Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Ryans are real tough.
Yeah.
I mean, so are the Chris's. I mean, the competing Chris scale actually is, you know, they move up and down the Chris charts. About who's trickiest and who isn't yet. But Artem, and definitely, like, those 4 movies got smaller and smaller as I wrote specs. Right. You know, like, yeah, that one's too big. Gonna have to write something smaller. Yeah, it's still smaller again.
Yeah.
But I also, I mean, again, I don't mind that. And even going forwards, you know, a lot of people do a small movie first nowadays.
Yeah.
So that they can then go and direct a giant movie.
Yes, of course.
I'm already really lucky, because I get to work on giant movies anyway. Now, not as a director, usually as a writer, sometimes as a producer, sometimes as a script doctor or edit doctor, which is kind of like my secret job.
Yeah.
So I know how those you know, machines function. And when they are a good machine with great people, usually with a small core of people at the heart, then they are amazing. But they are also, you know, prone, those machines, to breaking and creating bad, fingerprint-free product. And I say product, like, you know, on purpose. Because I know that, I didn't make Artemis just, you know, so that I can now bounce to Jack Ryan 6 or Jack Ryan's a TV show now. So actually, my next one as a director might be even smaller still. Or maybe it's a TV show, or maybe it's something that 3 hours long, and then I work out who wants it. You know, I think, you know, as you can even tell from this conversation, it's a process I'm working through. But I think it's a process that everyone that works in film is going through, particularly this year.
Yeah,
you know, because I think it's like we've hit the event horizon of what movies you should be put in the cinema.
Yeah, completely. So when you were writing, again, from watching it, the characters all seem so perfectly cast. So when you were writing, Did you have people in mind, or did it, is it one of them where you've got this story, you've got these characters, and then it is the studios kind of going, well, how about we do this?
Well,
do
because
that?
It was an indie, there was no studio.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, for good or for bad, most of the decisions in it, unless they're, you know, budget based.
Yeah.
Were by me.
Yeah.
You know? But no, I mean, it's interesting. People are like, did you write the central character with Jodie Foster in mind? No, I'd have to be fucking mental to write an indie movie with Jodie Foster in mind. I mean, she's literally acted once in the last 9 years.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought I was going to get Jodie Foster.
Amazing.
The one character that I did write with someone in mind was Charlie Day for Acapulco. And that's because he's one of my best mates.
Amazing.
And by the way, even then, the key is, I think, the thing to avoid is writing roles with actors in mind, even when they're your friends.
Yeah,
quite rightly, I told Charlie about the role, and he didn't, even though he's a brilliant, wonderful guy. It's not his job to go, yep, I'll definitely do it. He was like,
of course,
I'll read it. And then you're like, oh, shit. Like, now I've got, like, the toughest week ahead, because it's not just, like, anyone reading it. It's one of my best mates.
Yeah.
And luckily he read it and he was excited. And, you know, the reason I put him in the role is because, and wrote it for him, is there's a side of him I know. And also I know his history. He's actually a classically trained actor and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, giving Charlie something to really get his teeth into will be exciting to watch.
It was perfect. And I mean, I need to now take it on a slight tangent and show you something, because, so for years now, me and my goddaughter and her sister and her mum have done these film-based day trips. So we dressed up as the characters from The Life Aquatic at the London Aquarium.
Brilliant.
We did The Lion King at a zoo. But then for our Halloween night in, we decided to do Always Sunny.
Oh, really?
And we didn't have a Charlie, so I had to carve him out of a pumpkin. But we did have...
is amazing.
Everyone else. So just a little Danny DeVito in his natural
Danny
glasses.
Danny DeVito is just amazing. You've got to send me that.
I'll
show it to Charlie.
We posted that online. It's become now just our
interesting
our
thing about Always Sunny. Like, it has, you know, it's a TV show that's been on for 13 years. In America, it's on FX. I don't know where it is on in England.
On Netflix.
It's on Netflix.
On Netflix, yeah.
Well, so this is what's interesting. For a show that's been on 13 years, it has this, in the last couple of years, has this huge audience now, and it's because of Netflix. But it's almost like kids in America, when you talk to them, like people under 20, essentially.
Yeah.
It's almost like Friends for them. Which is weird, because it is this much smaller, much less, much more esoteric, much less mainstream show. But I think it's because it's all there.
Yeah.
It's like 12 times 13 episodes on Netflix, and you can drop in, and it's not episodic. You can watch any episode anytime.
Completely.
But it's been really interesting for the gang that make it, because, they've suddenly got this whole weird new level of relevancy that they didn't expect.
It's a bizarre one. Again, it's the impact of the slight non-existence of the world outside of Netflix.
Yeah, right. Points.
And we've seen it.
And that's a giant upside to it.
Yeah,
you know?
There was last year, Channel 4 had a show called End of the Fucking World, which was really good. And, it was bold and it was different. And when it came out, it got a reasonable reaction.
Yeah.
And then literally 3-4 months later, it went onto Netflix and it was in every paper. Everyone was talking about this new show. It's the best thing ever. It's like, it was all on TV. Literally earlier this year, like within a year, but it suddenly went on there and was the biggest thing ever. And everyone's talking about it. And it is that weird thing. And it's why when the TV show I've written, as I said, when Channel 4 and Sky and people like that have been lukewarm, it's been like, just give it a minute. Because in a minute, they're going to have that shock of the update that there isn't, as I said, there isn't 10 p.m. shows, there isn't this and that. Because Netflix just goes, oh, here it is. If you don't, that was on Channel 4 as a 10 p.m. show.
Yep.
As soon as we're on Netflix as just a show, it was one of the most talked about shows in the
year. Fascinating, isn't it?
Of the year.
I mean, because that is the upside of it. The terrifying thing as a creator then is you are completely at the mercy of the algorithm.
Yeah.
Because mostly on Netflix, if you make a thing, there's not going to be a billboard campaign or anything like that. It's just you're going to find out about it, A, if they've put a lot of money in it, because then they'll jam it onto the front page.
Yeah.
But mostly, if the algorithm, the phantom, the ghost in the machine, decides that the things you've watched before means you might like that.
Yeah.
And that is in and of itself a wee bit scary, I think, because, again, it suggests that a funneling of people's interests to maybe get tighter and tighter. That said, you then, you know, you can have fantastic breakouts and things can end up having a totally different second life.
Yeah.
Even more than they used to in, like, video and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't even think that's the Brave New World. I think it's the world we live in right now.
Yeah.
The industries around it have probably been too slow to catch up on that.
Yeah. And I think it's often a forced thing. I adore the BBC, but I've said numerous times that I think they got ahead of the curve completely by accident with their iPlayer stuff. It was a case of that they were getting rid of BBC Three or whatever, and like, oh, we're putting it on iPlayer, and it was more
it was basically a soft elbow.
We don't want people to protest us as they did for Six Music, but here it is, it's online, and then all of a sudden it went, everything was digital, and iPlayer is amazing, and it's got an amazing catalogue of stuff. But I generally think that was by mistake, so now I think everyone's playing catch-up a little bit, and that needs to go more into the commissioning side of things as well, to go, right, and on films as well, because films now are the hardest to get made. Like, speaking to Mark at Warp, he was saying how 5 years ago they were 80% films and 20% TV.
Oh, really?
And it's now flipped completely
to
80% TV and 20% films, because it's so hard to get films made. But, as said, I think when production companies start to learn that, accept that you're probably not going to get the cinema.
Yeah.
But there's still worth in this, there's still worth in Netflix and all of that kind of thing. Then we'll start to get back to having... Yeah,
that's the thing. It's like, you know, and again, you just have to listen to your idea. You have to look at the real world around you. You know, there's a phrase in Hotel Artemis that the bank robber uses to his brother as they're in a failed heist.
Yeah.
And actually, weirdly applies as a mantra, I think, to making any kind of art.
Yeah.
And it's work with what you've got, not what you hoped for. And I think that's really important. I think, and it definitely applies to making movies. You know, what you do when you write a script is you should then take a step back and go, okay, I thought I was making this, but what actually have I made? That's why it's so important to give your script to other people, to show your movie to other people.
Amazing.
And it's horrible.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely fucking horrible process.
Yeah.
Whether you couch it in notes or whether you just couch it as people's opinions or the look on their face or whatever it is, like, it's the one of the least enjoyable parts of it.
Yeah.
But it absolutely, if there's one thing I've learned over the last kind of 10 years of doing movies, it's you have to put it in front of people and let them beat the shit out of it.
Yeah.
You don't have to agree with them. Whether you're writing or whether you're making it, you absolutely do not have to agree with them. And sometimes... you know, you should run against what they think they want.
If you've got the right outlook, then if nothing else, it makes you firmer in the bits that are right about it. It will make you fight for them and go, no, here is the reason. I see what you're saying,
exactly.
Here's the reason. And on other bits, you'll say,
by the way, maybe I'll bring that out more because you're not spotting it. But there's an interesting thing in William Friedkin's amazing autobiography.
Right.
Friedkin did... The Exorcist.
Right,
And, I mean, he's just an incredible director. And he bounced between genres as well. But after The Exorcist, which was essentially like a hit like Star Wars then became, you know, there's some amazing photos in the book of, like, thousands of people queuing around blocks in New York for, like, 5 hours in its eighth week of release. Like, it didn't even do that well in its first couple of weeks. So it became a genuine cultural phenomenon. And then Friedkin was basically allowed to make anything he wanted. And he made some very good, incredibly weird films, including, like, Cruising, which is, you know, a snapshot of the gay club scene in 1980 in New York that has, like, genuine, sex in, you know, dark rooms and stuff like that. So, but it's no The Exorcist, I would say. And nor does it have to be. But Friedkin himself said that he thinks he made his best work, and specifically in the case of The Exorcist, because there was so much pushback from the studio. Now, right. He didn't really do any of the things that the studio told him to.
Yeah.
But they made him really interrogate the movie and his own work and understand what he felt was most important and what was worth fighting for, what hill is worth dying on. And then he didn't have that for his subsequent few movies. And he's on record in his book as saying, like, the movie suffered for not having a level of resistance from a studio. Now, again, there's a big difference between that and someone just walking into your edit suite and going, take that off, reshoot all of this for a month. We need a different movie.
Yeah.
But I do think resistance, particularly in filmmaking, is an important part of the process.
Yeah. So speaking of studios and opinions, and you touched earlier upon your secret job, it is a strange world in LA of rewrites and re-edits and changes and being a script doctor. I've been privy to a lot of it because of our mutual friend Kelly Marcel, who also is one of the masters of...
She is.
This film isn't working. We need to fix it.
Yeah.
Get Kelly in.
Yeah.
But again, it's weird because often those things will be uncredited or... Yeah. So how is that as a Brit in LA, being like one of those, like, other than spending all your time either in Soho House or up Runyon Canyon, because that's Brits in LA. That's how it happens.
They're the ones you want to avoid. Find me and Kelly in Soho House or up Runyon Canyon. You will find us in a little pub in Franklin Village, which is exactly between our houses on the east side.
Or her house, in fact, is where I recorded her, like when she came on the podcast with squirrels popping in and all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'd Kelly and her squirrels is a whole different thing.
I
don't even know how public that is. And that makes it sound much more nefarious than it actually is.
Touched upon it on the podcast.
Okay, it's public. Yeah. Kelly loves squirrels.
Yeah.
It's an interesting world. The old term of script doctoring almost doesn't really apply anymore. We haven't found a new word for it.
Yeah.
And there's also... There's lots of different stages of it. Mostly studio movies, and again, because they're getting bigger and bigger, they will have an initial writer, then other people will come on during the writing process, usually working essentially in tandem with whatever director has then come on, and then finally it gets shot. But on bigger movies in particular, there are two kinds of writing that come on in addition to that, and there are a few of us who do it, and... I personally try not to do it too often because I think it's important to have a balance of what you do. But it is a skill set, and it's actually a job I really enjoy as well.
Yeah.
And so one part of that is what's called the production rewrite.
Yeah.
And that's instead of signing up to do a draft of a script, however long that will take, the studios will bring you in when, for example, a movie is 3 months out of shooting, or 8 weeks out of shooting, or even shooting.
Yeah, yeah.
And there'll be very specific problems, be they giant or small.
Yeah.
And you get paid by the week.
Yeah.
And
that fee's often affected by if they're 8 months out or 3 months 100%. Out or actually shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. and the pressure, goes along with that.
Yeah,
you know, I did a movie where for a week I had to deliver new pages to Spielberg at 9 p.m. every night. So every morning you get up at 5 and you're like, shit. Whatever I write today is going to be read by Spielberg at the end of the day. And that's a weird pressure.
Hugely.
And that's why, there's a group of us that specifically sometimes get pulled in to do that. And honestly, you're only as good as the last one you did.
Yeah.
Because if I run a studio and someone essentially signs up for a weekly and I'm 4 weeks out, what you're essentially signing up for is, in the game of Believe, you're signing up as the writer to go, don't worry, I can fix it.
I got this.
It's going to be fine. Yeah. Exactly. And if you then fuck it up, then if I'm the head of that studio, I very much remember the name I wrote on the check.
Yeah,
the fact that I didn't save it.
Yeah.
And by the way, save is a very general term.
Of course.
Sometimes it is just fix a bit.
A specific problem. Yeah. Or specific,
But increasingly, there's a phrase in America where they describe something as inside baseball, which is like, when you're talking about a thing that's just too in, and I hope this part of the conversation isn't wildly fucking boring anyone other than the three people that are left, or that even came after they saw it was a person they'd never heard of. But the really fascinating area for me now is basically when a big movie shoots, and they usually shoot for about 70 to 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
They have a release date, usually about a year from when the shoot is. And invariably, because the release date comes before the script, more often than not, the script isn't necessarily in a great place by the time they start rolling.
Yeah.
And what's increasingly become very common is you shoot the script you have at the beginning, you go to the edit, you see what the movie then needs, and then instead of calling it like pickups to do more shooting or reshoots, you're not reshooting anything often. You are doing additional photography. You are working out what the story needs.
It was always a draft. That you were filming a draft.
And again, sometimes I think the old way of thinking about it, and actually what, does sometimes happen is, the script was a bit shit and we filmed the script and let's see how we can make the end movie better. But there's another way of looking at it, which is that it follows the iterative process that, for example, a Pixar movie does, which is, they make and remake their movies from both at script form and at animatic form and then in final animation form right up until the end for 5 years, sometimes 10.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons that Pixar movies are so often great is because they've had the time to A, fix problems, but B, really know what the movie is. The trouble with that when you're doing live action is it's so expensive.
Yeah.
To ramp up production again,
And the fact that the actors are actors and they go from job to job and
absolutely.
So on and so forth. So to tie everyone in to go, oh, we need you back next week. It's like, I'm not available for 4 months now. Oh.
Yeah. Henry Cavill's, infamous lack of an upper lip in Justice League.
Right.
Because he couldn't, because the Mission Impossible team were like, he can't shave the moustache. The moustache is a big part of
the
thing.
Right.
And so Henry Cavill did the 4 weeks of reshoots on Justice League with a giant moustache that they then had to digitally remove in every single shot. And there's so much of that stuff.
Yeah.
That's when it's infuriating is just the insane inefficiencies that can kind of come with that part of the process.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole culture now in Los Angeles of brilliant behind the scenes people, like proper heads of the department, like cinematographers, like production designers, who, because mostly big movies just never shoot in Los Angeles, right? Because there's no tax credits. I was very lucky. Hotel Artemis, because it's small enough, I got to shoot it in LA, which is where I live.
Fantastic.
But mostly it's Atlanta, it's Vancouver, it's London, it's Detroit. It's wherever there's a tax break that you can jam the movie into. But the reshoots always happen, or invariably happen, back in Los Angeles.
Right.
And so there is now a culture of these amazing behind-the-scenes artists that won't go do the big movie in Atlanta because, they've got, a 14-year-old and they want to be in the same town that their kid goes to school and they don't want to leave for 10 months. And because the reshoots themselves are so long, some of these, I wouldn't name the names of them, but, I know of a movie that got released last year where the reshoots were 8 weeks in LA, which means that's actually a 7-month gig if you're behind the camera.
You
can have a great living just doing that stuff.
Just picking it all up.
Yeah, the trouble is, how satisfying is that? Because, more often than not, you are you know, as much as I make it sound highfalutin and it's like, it's iterative, it's part of the storytelling process, more often than not, you are fixing it. You are patching up holes. You know, you are...
And again, anyone who's a writer and a creative, I think it's a combination of the two. Jobs like that are working your muscles. They're exercising you. They're keeping you sharp.
That's so true. You see, that's the other thing. Again, I don't think you want to do it all the time.
Yeah.
Because you become that thing. Mm-hmm. But I honestly, there are a ton of skills that I picked up and honed by doing that kind of forensic
and again,
studio stuff that folded back into
it's
Artemis.
It's making you see other people's scripts and what works and what
100%.
When I was first starting as script writer, I spoke to Kelly and said, what books should I read on script writing? She said, don't read any, read scripts.
Yeah, I never did.
She said, get some good scripts, get films you love, and she sent me a load of hers and all sorts of other stuff. It's like, read them and learn from that. So you're seeing what you like and what you dislike.
Yeah.
And going off that. And that's an ideal thing. If you're having to look at scripts that don't work, then you can see where the mistakes are and what the corrections are. And that's a great way to learn for when you're then like, right, now I've got time to do the one that's my idea and my passion project and whatever else. And
absolutely. Plus there's also, you know, the horror of being a script writer is however much a scene may work on a page, when it gets shot, it may simply not work. Yeah. And there can be a million reasons from that. That can be your fault. It can be the weather on the day. It can be one of the actors never nailed
100%.
It. 100%. Or it could just be the weird negative alchemy that is, okay, that scene doesn't work. And that's a really interesting thing.
It can be heartbreaking.
Oh, my God.
I did a film at the end of last year, and I saw the final edit of it a week or two ago. And my scene that was my hardest scene on the day has been cut. But it's because it was outside and it was raining.
Right.
And we tried to cover it as much as we could and get away with it, but none of the other evening shoots had rain. Well, so literally the whole bit that I spent all night and I had a stunt to do and all sorts of stuff like that. And it's like, we worked all, but it couldn't work the way it wanted because of rain.
And there are also times when the scene is absolutely, and this again, you know, seeing this in other people's movies because of doing this more forensic work is really helpful. Because there are times when the scene itself is perfect. Everyone did nail it.
Yeah.
But when you zoom back and take the 30,000 foot view of the movie, you don't need that scene.
Doesn't work. Yeah.
You just don't need it.
Yeah.
And the movie feels long, so, well, what happens if we take it? And like, the day in the edit that you take out your favourite scene, it's so painful. And then invariably you watch it and you instantly know it was the right decision.
It's valid, though, because it's looking at it as an album rather than a collection of singles.
Right. Yeah,
it's saying it all needs to flow together. And this one scene, well, that is going to someday be in one of your future films or this person's future films. It'll be amazing. You'll make that again.
Yeah.
But it's not right for this.
No.
For this moment.
And people know that you cut, you know, people in the world, I think, know that you have to cut lines when you're, but I don't think people realize that sometimes you have to cut what were the best bits. Now, and again, like, if you're in control of the edit, then if you still absolutely love something, that it might be the scene that was the whole reason you ever thought of the movie.
Yeah.
You can keep it in. And if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said, you should keep it in. Because it's the reason you made the movie. But again, I think you have to listen to the thing you've made. I think you have to work with what you've got, not what you hoped for.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, I would say, you know, that scene's got to go.
Completely, and it's a skill to have that strictness on that. A great example I have is I remember being mates with Tom Hardy and a few of them through Kelly. I remember hearing that they had done a scene in the new Star Wars film, and this is all publicly out there.
I'd done
a film in the new Star Wars film, and then when it came out, that scene had been cut. And again, that's a hard choice to make, but it didn't work in the story in the edit. They've secretly got a really good Easter egg there that could have got them some good press to
absolutely.
Be secretly, we've got Tom Hardy, we've got this person and that person. But no, it didn't.
Plus, also,
it
like,
make the cut
Tom's
it
a big
read.
Star. Like, having to call Tom or Tom's people, depending on, you know, your speed and mileage, and say, it was, you know, that day that you told everyone in your family about, and maybe your kid, if you've got a kid, like, you know, where you got to be in Star Wars. Bad news.
You're not
in it.
It's hard. It's a hard call to make.
I know actors who've turned up to premieres not realizing that their appearance has been absolutely ribboned.
Hands up. I got an invite to the King Arthur premiere, which was my first ever thing. And I only realised later, the reason I got the invite is because of the podcast.
Oh, really?
Because I got the invite and I didn't go in then, but I'd hit my agent up saying, oh, I've been invited, blah, blah. And no, I'd spoken to Neil Maskell, who was also in it, and he was amazing. He really helped me out a lot and guided me along. And he said, oh, the cast and crew is a couple of days before. That's far more fun. Come to that. Yeah. So I hit them up. And then I got an email saying, oh, we meant to let you know the story arc. Because, again, it was another one that had almost half a year of reshoots. Because there was big changes.
Yeah.
So it came out over a year late and things like that. And the story arc I was on, that whole arc had been taken out. Therefore, all of my scenes. And I'd shot for a few weeks on it. So it's not like I'd had one day, but all of it was gone. And that was it. I found out, I'm glad I'd sent that email and spoken to Neil rather than just turned up at the premiere with either my mum or my girlfriend or whoever else being like, this is exciting, and then watched it and been, I'm not in it, am I?
Yeah, I know. And the
but again, equally, I was fine because I got the experience. It was my first ever acting experience. I got to be directed by Guy Ritchie and all this, work with these people. And equally, I understand how it works. Having seen the film, it got panned a bit. I really enjoyed it. And I felt the corrections they'd made is what made it great. The issues that hit, where they'd had to remove a story, it felt like it made them do some classic Guy Ritchie kind of a guy doing a voiceover and telling a story over quick cuts and stuff like that, which might not have been there if they hadn't.
No, and that's the other thing, again, cliche though it is, the chaos of making things, can often make the thing stronger because you're making decisions in the moment. You're kind of listening to everything that's happening around you. Chris McQuarrie, who directed the last two Mission Impossible movies, who I was lucky enough to work with on Rogue Nation at the script stage. You know, he talks about that because those movies are, you know, he went into the new Mission Impossible with a 33-page script and they ended up shooting for, I think, 185 days.
Yeah.
And again, like, as long as someone's willing to write the checks for that, he and Tom have become, have become incredibly adept at that being their modus operandi. But even McQuarrie, who probably has more experience of like keeping a blockbuster on the rails when there's not that much on the page, even he says, "But I'm not going to be the one that like creates chaos on purpose to do that."
Sure,
that's mental.
That's
absolutely mental, and it's also kind of stupid. Yeah. Like that's like a psychosis. The act of making a movie will absolutely throw a million challenges at you anyway.
Yeah.
So, but it's the key to you know how you deal with it in the moment that often actually makes the movie good or not.
And this is just a small side note, but Rogue Nation is an important movie for me because every year on my birthday, it's this Friday, August 3rd.
Happy birthday for August 3rd.
I go to the cinema often on my own in the morning because that's what I love to do. I love to be in the cinema, and that's it. And one year, I think, I can't remember what film was out at the same time, but I'd lined up something that was a bit more alternative and hip and trendy. I can't think what it was now. But then the opportunity to see it in the week came up earlier, so I'd seen it. So on my birthday, I was like, I like the Mission Impossible films. I'll go and see Rogue Nation. And it was one of the most fun times I've had in the cinema. Because just from start to finish, it's such a, like we were speaking of cinema films, it's such a cinema film. Wow. And I sat there with my hot dog and my ice cream.
Yeah,
and everything.
Right.
It was just,
absolutely
perfect. And that was the kind of thing, it was that people will tell you that birthdays should be about you're going out and getting drunk or doing this or doing that. I was like, that was one of my favourite birthdays. Because I was just sat there just watching a proper cinema film and just enjoying it all.
And that is movies as rides, you know, is a kind of term that gets derided, but partly because it denotes the idea that it's just that it'll be a theme park ride.
Yeah.
What McQuarrie and Tom have absolutely worked out, and particularly if you see Fallout, is Mission Impossible movies are rides. Yeah. That doesn't mean they're like 100 miles an hour every single second.
Sure.
But like I think can be an emotional ride as well as an adrenalized ride.
Yeah.
And I think again, it speaks to that thing of like, an audience being used to controlling their narrative now because of Netflix. If you make, if you craft that ride, be it emotionally or action-led, well enough and expertly enough, then they're not going to get up and have a piss or look on their phone, or because you, because you're in.
Exactly.
It's immersive.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's hard to do. It's hard to do. Yeah. And, it takes skill and experience and some luck and a lot of resources usually.
It's fascinating to see when we have those rare situations that people get to work together continually, that quite obviously that pays off. And Mission Impossible is a prime example of they seem to be getting received better and better as they go along. It's a franchise that's improving because it's them working together
Tom and McHugh have been working together. They've done 9 movies in 12 years.
Yeah.
Like, they know how to work together.
That makes so much sense, but it's so rare. It's so often that everyone has to go off and just do all these different things. Oh, I've worked with them now.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
Yeah, and it used to be much less rare. I mean, I think you still see it in a lot of the smartest actors.
Yeah.
We talked about the Ryans earlier. Gosling absolutely tends to favor the same group of directors
because
he trusts them, you know, and they understand him, they understand his process. And, and behind the camera, you do it the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, if you find a cinematographer that you love and
of course
his or her work suits the next movie, then you're definitely going to go to them first.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we're over the hour mark, and there's tons I wanted to talk about, but there's two things I need to make sure I get in.
Yeah, sure.
And one of them is, can we talk about the day you got to bring your kid to set on your debut movie, on the film that you've crafted and written and
slaved over? No one's ever asked me that.
How was that?
There's a kind of preamble to that.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple of lads, one's 7, one's 1.5, and the second kid was born, and then 2 weeks later, Hotel Artemis was suddenly a go.
Wow.
So that was fucking insane.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? I'm a smart guy. I've put this in LA.
Yeah.
That means I can still be a dad.
Yeah.
And I can make my first movie.
Oh, how foolish.
I literally, like, and then I was in the pub with Taika Waititi, brilliant filmmaker, obviously.
He's one of my absolute favourites.
Oh, he's amazing. Genius. He's a force of nature. And he was like, oh, you fucked that. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, you need to be as far away from all other commitments as possible.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, and he explained it really well, actually, because he was like, a broken promise is much worse than the reality of what will happen.
Yeah.
And so
I'm a big believer in under promise and over deliver than over promise and under deliver. Because, I mean, again, that is the way it just goes.
It's the story of my life.
Yeah.
But but he was like, you know, if your kid knows you're gone,
yeah,
that's tough on them, but they'll get their head around that.
But they know what it is.
Yeah, they know what it is. If you say you're gonna be home for bath time and then you don't, that's a more acute thing. And by the way, or you get home for bath time, but because directing is so all-consuming, you're completely vacant anyway.
And that's a lesson in all walks of life.
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
This isn't inside baseball. This is real. This is that.
I agree completely.
That awareness. And again, I've had friends in the past who will be out and they'll be calling home saying, I'll be home soon. And I'll be like thinking, you've just ordered shots. You know you're not going to... You know it's going to be a while. And again, if you just said, I haven't caught up with these guys in a while, I'll be home about midnight, then that would be fine. But because you're saying,
no,
I won't be long, that it then becomes this horrible thing. And
I think that's right. And I think, you know, it's one of those things I've found easier in as I've gotten a bit older as well. Partly probably through the experience of, like, realising that the broken promise version kind of just gives me a kick in the bollocks more than anyone else.
Yep, yep, yep.
But the weird thing was, even though we shot the movie in LA and my family are in LA, I actually had to get this horrible little cheap divorced dad apartment next to the studio, which is only like 2.5 miles away from my house.
Yeah.
And it was like a coffin, literally, because like it had glass windows, but they hadn't afforded to put blinds on them, and half of the movie was shot at night anyway, so I had to sleep. So literally just I just taped black paper up around entire. So it was a fairly, you know, one could call it a monastic experience.
Yeah.
It was also a bit like living in a coffin for the 8 weeks of directing my movie.
Get it.
So, but what was great is that once I got my, you know, feet under the table a bit after, you know, the first couple of weeks as a director, I was able to, you know, my older kid was able to come down and be on set. And honestly, the first day he came down, it's so cheesy, but it's also entirely true. It is the most proud I've ever been, like, on a working day. You know, and again, it was possible because it's an indie movie. It's a smaller machine. Yeah. Like, you know, but like, you know, he got to sit next to me on a director's chair at the monitors. You know, he got to shout action for a couple of scenes.
Yeah.
He got to see Sofia Boutella's amazing action sequence take place.
Perfect,
and it's amazing. And he genuinely, and again, this is one of the lovely things about it, he watched Sofia kick 11 male stuntmen's asses. And then he turned to me and he was like, I want to be her.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, and so
it's beautiful as well, because it's a beautiful experience to share, but it's also an education of context for...
Yeah.
Why is dad away? Because no matter how much you tell or explain, it will still be a dad's not here this week or whatever else it'll be. That moment makes it all go, oh, right, I get it. This is why it's for something great. It's for something positive.
Yeah,
it's not just going, oh, I'm at the office.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's not just that, which again, as a kid, you might not be able to understand or compute.
Yeah,
so.
But I think it's also important, like, to all the parts of the releasing a movie I've tried to share. And I don't social media my kids. There's not a picture of their faces on online. They can, you know, they can make that decision themselves. So
perfect.
I don't really talk about it much, but there's one thing that was interesting is, you know, the movie came out in America and it got some great reviews and it got some really negative reviews.
Right.
And they bummed me out because truthfully, it's not like I expected everyone to like it, but the people that didn't like it, I expected them to be like, it's just a movie. And some of them were, for reasons that I still don't really understand, like, wildly vicious.
It's the mad thing when you're first releasing anything, is you forget how little you read reviews before. Because I don't read reviews. Again,
no.
It was a shock to me early on when you were saying, it's been for some people and it's not been, because I watched, I was like, this is amazing. I assumed everyone loves this. I assumed this is what I mean.
That's the weird thing.
It was that thing. But as soon as, I've had it with music. As soon as we put something out, it was like caring about every single review. It's like, I've never read that magazine. I've never cared about, I don't know who that person is. They've got no context, yet they're affecting my life and mood. And it's natural.
Yeah,
it's
and by the way, and that is the thing. It does affect your life and mood. And it should, because if you care about a thing, then it's going to feed back into your life. But
if someone's talking shit on it, you're going to be like, what?
Well, I felt like it was really important because my older kid had been there, like, through the experience of me making a movie, my first movie. And though he will not see it for years because I will not let him because it is not suitable because he's seven.
Sure.
He will, when it came out, I wanted to share that part as well. Because I do think generationally there is a thing at the moment where, you know, I've helicopter parented him into, you know, thinking that, you know, that you can't fail and to be afraid of failure.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, I need to share the downsides of creativity with him as well. And so I was like, you know what? I'm a bit bummed out today, and I explained to him, like, you make a thing, some people don't like it, some people do like it, you can't control that, you shouldn't control that.
No.
And actually I think it was part of the reminder to me of, like, oh, I didn't fucking make this for everyone to like it. I made it for the people who get it to get it. And it was nice to be able to kind of, like, to feed that back in, you know.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And again, yeah, it's a beautiful thing to get to share those things and to give those life lessons as you're learning them as well, if you know what I mean. So it's not just, here's dad, I'll tell you. It's going, no. Oh, I'm surprised. This is affecting me more than I thought.
This is happening live in the room.
It's a beautiful a lesson to give. So as I wrap things up, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the the rumors I've read and the vagueness around the Ghostbusters movie that you were working on. I don't know how much you can say or can't say. I know this industry's not one.
I mean,
one.
Like, technically, I don't know how much I can say either, so I won't give you, like, the full shebang. But honestly, it was actually really simple. It was just, it's one of those frustrating things where the reality of a situation was wildly misrepresented.
Yeah.
And refuting those the report
claims
were kind of was only going to make it weirder and harder.
Yeah, yeah,
but basically, the Russo brothers wanted to make a Ghostbusters movie. They asked me if I had any ideas. I had an incredibly wild idea that, and they were like, "Yes, we should do that." they'd been talking about a couple of male actors, and so that ended up becoming part of the conversation. But actually, the idea was two blokes, two women, and a ghost. That was the ghost-busting team in it.
Right.
But what happened was, for some reason, it leaked as a... This is the male Ghostbusters and the female Ghostbusters, which was the one that was already in production with Paul Feig. You know, it's the answer to that. And there'd already been a bunch of shit by idiots online who didn't want a female Ghostbusters. And so we became some kind of false totem for them. And then it all got horribly messy because, Ivan Reitman, who is the original director of the amazing first Ghostbusters movie, you know, he announced that I was writing it, and then weirdly, put out a statement saying there is only one Ghostbusters movie, and that was weird because it came from the same person, and that confused everyone even more. But truth be told, all that really happened was we developed a movie. The female Ghostbusters was always ahead in production. They made it, and our movie went away, happens every day.
Constantly.
Constantly. So weirdly, it wasn't that controversial. I'm sad because we had a really good idea, and the Russos nailing a big Ghostbusters movie would be fucking brilliant. Who knows? Maybe it comes back around. You never know. Yeah. But the whole idea of ours was like to do a Ghostbusters that wasn't about a group of scientists.
Right.
Because that felt like, oh, that's a totally different way into the universe.
Of course,
So I doubt it will ever happen. I definitely doubt it will happen with me involved. But and we never even wrote a script, but I wrote a scriptment.
Yeah.
Which is, a 20-page version of it. And I love it, and the Russos loved it. So who knows wild and woolly world of show business?
Exactly. So the perfect way to wrap things up then, do you know, I normally ask what's ahead, but do you know what's ahead? Do you have an idea or plan of what you want to do next, whether it be writing or directing or producing or where?
I mean, personally speaking, what I hope to do after Hotel Artemis and some of the other stuff is continue to make small writer-director movies, smaller writer-director movies, but keep working as a writer and producer on the giant ones. Because, the absence makes the heart grow fonder. Directing a tiny indie movie for 2 years makes you miss just being the writer on a giant train set of
100%,
a film. 100%. And vice versa. You do that for a bit and then you're like, fuck, I just want to get back to, directing.
Well, that's it. So anything other than
the thing you're doing
or write a director is always a project that you do your work on and then you walk away.
Whereas
as the writer director, there's no walking away at any point. You're there from that. Like even for the actors, you're there for this moment. You have your big rap party and then you're on to the next film.
Yeah.
The director is still in that film.
And your head's above the parapet, So honestly, a mix of those things is what I want to do. I mean, I know what my next big thing is as a writer and producer, and that's really exciting, but I can't talk about it. And I've got a bunch of ideas that I want to do as my next thing as a director. I think, again, it kind of comes back to a lot of what we've talked about, which is where does this idea live?
Yeah.
And how best can this story be told? And so that's actually one of the things I'm just working out now, and that's exciting. It should be exciting.
I love that. Well, thank you very much of your time, and I'll let you get on with your day, and I'll let these people get back to having the basement of the Queen of Hoxton have kindly let us
Absolutely.
Come in and chat away.
The last time I was here, I was in a very different state.
Any clubs in the daytime are just, it's weird, isn't it?
Also, like, I'm 40. I don't go to clubs anymore. This is the closest I've come to the Queen of Hoxton.
I run a club not up the road, which is at the book club, which is the sister venue of this, and I only go to clubs when it's my club night. It's that thing. Me and the guy I ran it with, Stu, were saying the other day, I was like, I'm loving this, but I wouldn't be here if we weren't doing this. Honestly, I'd be at home watching
the idea of
Netflix.
Being up that late makes me want to cry a bit.
Completely.
Actually, so. All right,
thank
man,
you very much
thank
for your
you.
Time.
Thanks
it's been
for
a
having
pleasure.
Me.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Drew Pearce. I hope you enjoyed that. I absolutely adored it. It's a real kind of behind the curtain of the film industry, which you don't get to hear or see very often. So I was delighted with that. We mentioned Kelly Marcel, who was a previous guest. Feel free to go and check that one out. She's one of my favourite humans ever invented, so that's good. And yeah, as I mentioned, I've started a Patreon now, patreon.com/scroobiuspip. $1 a month, that is it. You can go and have a look at what's going on over there. Yeah, thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week with Angel, who I believe is one of the best guests I've ever had, and it's going to blow your minds. You're going to be tweeting about it and going crazy on social media about it. So yeah, check that out, and I will see you next week. I should always mention that my club night is back September 29th at the Book Club. I've got Dan Lesak DJing. I've got Get Cape Wear Cape Fly DJing. I've got DJ Destruction, Push Music, Hardcore Listing DJs, and myself DJing in a rubber lizard mask. Come down to the Book Club. I will see you then. You can pre-buy tickets at the Book Club's website. It's the Book Club London or the Book Club Hoxton or something. Or you can put your names on the guest list by emailing info@thetrashsociety.com. So, yeah, I will see you all soon. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.